The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, but I'm not there. I'm in Atlanta. I'm at the Atlanta airport, in fact. We had a great event last night with Herschel Walker and Alfredo Ortiz of the Job Creators Network. And my friend Brian Westbury, who might be on the same plane, though he's going to Chicago and I'm going to California. Sitting in for me, the one and the only, the irrepressible, the Steelers fan who knows the sun is setting in Pittsburgh, Ed Morrissey. Take it away, Ed.
Good morning, everyone. This is Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for you today in the ReliefFactors.com studio. And taking your calls at 800-520-1234. Hey, it's a great morning here in Texas, but we have to start with a traffic report in Los Angeles. I just want to ask everybody else around the country to bear with us. It turns out that when we're taking a look around here, that there are very few SIG alerts between midnight and 6 a.m. in Los Angeles. Who knew this? I had no idea. I lived in Los Angeles for, 30-something years, and I never knew until yesterday that, you know, the traffic is actually a little quieter around L.A. in the middle of the night because apparently nobody goes out there. So for all of you truck drivers out there, all of you brand-new truck drivers out there, all you brand-new warehouse workers, you don't have to worry about traffic. There are no SIG alerts. First off, I'm not sure that anybody even remembers SIG alerts. This is something that was bigger than when I was a kid. Do they still use SIG alerts in Southern California?
Actually, they do. If it's an accident that's bad enough, an unplanned lane closure for 30 minutes or longer is defined as a SIG alert, and it's named for a guy named Lloyd Sigmund, who is a old time radio broadcaster on a station called KMPC back in the day.
Part of Gene Autry's radio network. Yes. Yeah, the old cowboy himself. Yeah, the SIG alerts were. If you grew up in Los Angeles or Southern California, you grew up with SIG alerts. When you heard SIG alert, you knew
everywhere
the
else in
was
the country.
Stopped.
Everywhere in the country, you deal with weather reports. In L.A., you never dealt with weather reports because we have no weather here. But everybody, every 6 minutes, was turning on to get a traffic report so they know which way to try to avoid traffic was.
Well, I mean, that's because you have no weather in Los Angeles. I mean, a typical weather report, a typically honest weather report in Los Angeles would be today, be prepared for lots of smog. There'll be a new front of smog rolling in around noon, and that front of smog will roll out about 4 p.m., and a brand new front of smog will roll in at 5 p.m., and it will be smoggy for the rest of the week. I mean, that's Los Angeles weather. I mean, that's about it. Other than Santa Ana's, that's the only thing you ever hear about weather in Southern
right.
California.
You know, the weather today is going to be 83 degrees and partly hazy.
So hazy you could chew it, especially when I was a kid. You know, the other thing you heard besides smog alerts was stage one smog alert, or besides SIG alerts were stage one and stage two smog alerts. Stage three smog alerts, I think, existed. I don't know if I ever heard of one actually in place, but basically that was a stage three smog alert was put a wet T-shirt over your head and don't breathe.
Yes.
Those were the things that you heard about. There's no weather in Los Angeles. There's smog. And there's SIG alerts. But there are no SIG alerts in the middle of the night, Dwayne. And you know how I know this? Because I watched Joe Biden's press conference yesterday in which he revealed to the whole country that in Southern California, the traffic's not so bad between midnight and 6 a.m.
We finally have a solution to the great crisis facing this country now that is your Christmas presents.
Wait a minute. No, we actually have a name for the great crisis. Because Joe Biden actually provided us a name.
Oh, yes, we do.
Supply chains. If you've never heard of supply chains, first off, if you've never heard of supply chains, Congratulations on your first birthday, and we hope that you really enjoyed the cake.
And we hope you go back and sleep under that rock that you just came out of.
So, yes, Joe Biden explained to us that you may not have ever heard of supply chains, which is maybe true for everybody who's under, I don't know, 12 years old. But if you have heard of supply chains, that's what the problem is. And, Dwayne, we should really just go to the cuts here because, I mean, these are something else. Let's go to cut one.
Yeah, it's theater of the absurd. Yeah, let's go to cut number one. Here's the big announcement of what the problem is, and I'm here to fix it.
I know you're hearing a lot about something called supply chains and how hard it is to get a range of things from a toaster to sneakers to bicycles to bedroom furniture. And that's why back in February, I signed a piece of legislation on supply chain, an executive order on supply chains, and what we had to move on it. And with the holidays coming up, you might be wondering if gifts you plan to buy will arrive on time. Well, let me explain.
Well, let me explain. If he signed an executive order back in February, and we're still having problems with supply chains, and we're not just having problems with supply chains. There are 61 container ships parked off the port of Los Angeles. That's down from 70, by the way, because the industry had already started to adopt the 24/7 model.
Do you remember the oil spill?
The oil spill was caused by one of these container ships dragging its anchor across an old oil head that had been capped off. And a lot of these ships out there, or at least some of these ships out there, aren't even anchored. There isn't any more anchorage for them. So they're having to drift. And that's dangerous as well.
Right. The water is deep enough. They really can't drop anchor. And so they are they're just floating.
Did you see I saw this pop up on Twitter, by the way. We're going to be talking about supply chains because this is a huge deal in terms of inflation. It's a huge deal in terms of supply and demand. I mean, this is actually a very big deal. And the fact that he signed an EO in February and they're just coming back around to this now is a measure of just how badly they've bungled this. This whole Biden administration is about taking your eye off the ball of everything. These guys don't have their eyes on the ball in any of these areas, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, because they've completely wrapped their arms around this entire progressive agenda. We'll get to some of that later in the show too. I know that listeners are going to be interested to find out, you know, what the status of that reconciliation bill is. But for right now, let's stick with supply chains. There was a tweet last night and from Representative Michelle Steele. She is a Republican out of, I believe, well, it's California. It's 48th District, California.
Yeah, she just beat Harley Ruta. It's Dana Rohrabacher's old seat.
Right. And you know, Michelle Steele is somebody who's a fairly adept person here. She's on the Transportation Committee. But she announced late on Tuesday that she was going to introduce legislation to ban cargo ships off the Orange County coast. Ships anchored for weeks and months off our coast likely caused last week's oil spill, which was what we were just talking about. Reports that the pipe may have been struck several other times by ship anchors off the coast. Well, that's not a solution. You can't. The problem isn't that the ships are there. The problem is that the ships haven't unloaded yet. If you're going to ban ships off the coast of Orange County, then you're basically saying that no other ships can now arrive. There's no other place to go, at least not in California. And that's where the main hubs are for the supply chains inside the United States for imported goods. That's not a solution.
That's like banning air traffic coming into O'Hare for that you can't circle and you can't hover around because ground traffic is too bad on tarmac. So you've got
more simple analogy. It's like saying we're not going to expand freeway capacity, even though, traffic's backed up. We're going to actually dismantle the 5. Right. Dismantle the five because traffic is too heavy.
We're going to ban cars in East LA for loitering because traffic is too bad and you're stopped.
Yeah, I mean
it's not a solution.
It's not a solution. In fact, it would make the supply chain issues worse because then we would stop getting ships coming to the United States, and you would never get your Christmas presents. A point we're going to come back to anyway.
Right. The overarching point that we're going to get back to is that the Biden administration has no solution here. They don't understand what the problem is. You and I talked about the problem last night. We will talk about it today. There is a real problem in the supply chain, and this administration is not addressing it.
Well, the fact that he issued an EO in February, and this is the first time that he's talked about it since, tells you that they just haven't managed this issue. And this is a situation that requires a lot of management. This is not as simple as just saying, oh, okay, now that we shut everything down, we'll just open things back up and it will return to normal. That's not the way this works. The supply chain logistical system inside the United States, for imports especially, isn't very, very complicated, and a few extra shifts in the middle of the night are not going to solve it. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this. I'm Ed Morrissey from HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh. We'll be right back.
Thank you, Ed Morrissey. Don't go anywhere, America. Got to remember, check your Birch Gold holdings, and if you haven't checked them yet this morning, Ed can come back and tell you what the price of gold is this morning. Birch Gold is who I buy my gold from, who Ed buys his gold from. If he buys gold and if he doesn't buy gold, Ed, you should be buying gold from Birch Gold. Well, actually, you're going to go to HughGold.com. That's pretty easy to remember, HughGold.com. Or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. There's probably a story on inflation this morning. I don't know. I'm winging my way west. But I'll tell you one thing. We talked about inflation last night with Brian Westbury at the Atlanta History Center, and I can tell you, I can assure you, it is here and it's going to get worse. You need to diversify. You need some gold. You need to get it from Birch Gold via HughGold.com. Even if you can't buy any gold for yourself right now, diversify your IRA. Get the free information package from Birch Gold via HughGold.com. Don't forget as well, ReliefFactor.com. I think Ed takes it. We should find out if Ed takes it so he could do these spots for me when I'm traveling on the road. ReliefFactor.com, Icarian and Kirkman, Resveratrol and Omega. I haven't been live since last night in Atlanta, so I can't tell you if the usual thing happens where someone comes up to me and says, I take Relief Factor every single day. But I can tell you, ReliefFactor.com does indeed work. ReliefFactor.com. Icarian, Curcumin, Resveratrol, and Omega. It's what you need to make your day complete. It's what you need to feel good about the way the day is going because it begins with a pain-free, aggravation-free morning walk, run, or commute. ReliefFactor.com, $19.95. Get you started. Go out and get it today.
Welcome back. This is Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for you in the ReliefFactor.com studios. And joining me right now is Dr. Michael Oren, former Israeli Deputy Prime Minister for Diplomacy and Ambassador to the United States. Dr. Oren, welcome back. Great to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you, Ed.
Big story coming from the Washington Free Beacon. I know that this is something that's gotten a lot of attention in Israel, has gotten next to none here in the United States. Adam Credo reporting yesterday that U.S. Iran envoy Robert Malley, whose name is very familiar to those of us who follow these things, says that the Biden administration is preparing for, quote, a world where Iran doesn't have constraints on its nuclear program. Comments that show how little progress has been made in negotiation with Tehran. Regarding a return to the JCPOA, the 2015 Barack Obama-Iran deal. Dr. Oren, I mean, if that deal had remained in place, we'd still be dealing with an Iran that didn't have any constraints on its nuclear weapons program. I mean, I think that that's one thing that should be said right off the bat. That deal wasn't going to prevent Iran from creating nuclear weapons. It only had a 10-year pause in it, maybe, and that's only if you believed Iran was complying with it.
Yeah, that's true. Iran was ultimately going to have an unlimited nuclear program. The big difference was that while it restrained itself somewhat on some aspects of the program, just on the nuclear enrichment, not on missile development, not on the development of advanced centrifuges, not on development of a warhead, didn't do anything about any of that, Right. But Iran was going to get paid $100 billion that it wasn't going to spend on schools and hospitals. You can believe that. I think the major thing that Rob Malley is saying, believe it or not, is the truth. And it's the truth that has been around for a long time. I've been talking about it on the Israeli news, and that is the United States is willing to coexist with an Iran that has threshold capacity. That means the ability to create a bomb within a matter of weeks, sometimes even a matter of days. Among the professionals, it's referred to as Japan-like capabilities, because Japan has that capability, but of course, Japan is not threatening to wipe anybody off the map.
Right.
Or is not supporting international terror. It's a big difference. America, that's what when President Biden or other American officials say, you know, Iran will never get a bomb on our watch. Yeah, but do they have the ability to make one real quickly? So America maybe exists with a threshold capacity of Iran, a Japan-like Iran, if you will, but Israel can't. It just simply can't. Every time
yes.
we go to war with Hezbollah, we go to war with Hamas, Iran's going to threaten to break it out, and it's going to be a huge constraint on our ability to defend ourselves.
Well,
and
I mean,
I personally believe the Iranians will someday even get a bomb. They won't be satisfied with threshold capacity.
Well, Dr. Oren, I mean, the problem here is multifold, really. I mean, first off, Iran's IRGC having nuclear weapons is one concern. But the bigger concern, I think, especially for Israel, is that Hezbollah and Hamas will get nuclear weapons, clandestinely and deploy them without Iranian fingerprints on them. And they're literally on your doorstep. Iran is at least some distance away. That's, I think, the biggest concern. Am I correct about that?
You are correct. So Iran can have threshold capacity. Maybe it doesn't break out, but it could pass on nuclear technologies to its proxies, to Hezbollah, to Hamas. They could develop, for all we know, tactical nuclear weapons and put them right on our border. And Iran would say, well, we don't have a nuclear weapon. These guys, hey, we don't have anything to do with these guys. And that presents Israel with an existential threat. So Iran having a threshold capacity is just intolerable for this country. And it's interesting. Yesterday, the foreign minister, Yair Lapid, met with Tony Blinken, the secretary of state, and he was upfront about it. He says, we will not let Iran have a threshold capacity, and we will act. Tony Blinken didn't say that. He said that all options would be on the table. He did not repeat what President Obama even would also say, was that all options on the table, including the military option. Administration does not say that anymore. And he was actually pressed by a journalist, Blinken was, to say, do the options include a military option? He dodged the question.
Well, I mean, that doesn't surprise me. What's the debate been like in Israel on this? I mean, clearly American media is not doing a great job of covering this particular development, but in Israel, I know they're very concerned. What's the debate been like there about what the options are?
It's not even a debate, to tell you the truth. Israelis focus on other things. I'm running for being the head of the Jewish Agency, the largest Jewish philanthropy in the world. That is front page news every day. No one wants to even think about the Iranian issue.
Interesting.
No one paid much attention to Yair Lapid's press conference yesterday. I thought it was hugely significant, hugely significant. Maybe it's just too awful to contemplate, but, as the winter comes and the skies cloud up and our Air Force can't operate, the same type of freedom that came during the summer and the spring, as Iran reaches military-grade enrichment, their ability to break out while the world is occupied with something else, maybe there'll be a storm somewhere, maybe there'll be an earthquake, and then you wake up one morning and Iran is a nuclear power. It'll be just like that. That's how the North Koreans did it. Anyway, even that's how the Indians did it. But for us, it's intolerable situation.
A completely intolerable situation, and this was the reason why we were applying the sanctions on Iran. One of the reasons why we were applying the sanctions on Iran that we were. Robert Malley, just really briefly, we only got a couple seconds left. Robert Malley was saying that they would have dropped all the sanctions. Dr. Oren, I got 10 seconds. I'll let you respond to that.
Yeah, of course. I think we'll do anything possible to get that agreement back, knowing that in the end, Iran will have a nuclear weapon.
Dr. Michael Oren, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to stay tuned on that story, believe me. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. We'll be right back.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
.com studios, the Texas version of this. I'm not broadcasting from Pittsburgh, where the sun is always rising in Pittsburgh, especially this time of the morning, and having a great time. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. Joining me right now is my friend, my podcast partner, and the proprietor of BearingArms.com, Cam Edwards. We're here to talk about Virginia and some Second Amendment stories. And Cam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ed. Good morning.
It seems like it only seems like yesterday that I talked to you, Cam. I mean, it's, Cam and I
Ryan,
do.
Well, listen, I appreciate you. You invited me on. This is fantastic.
Yeah, Cam and I do a weekly VIP Gold podcast for Town Hall, the Town Hall's VIP Gold program, and we have a great time every Wednesday afternoon, hanging out for an hour. We're not going to do it an hour today. We're only going to do a segment or two today, but. Two different stories. Of course, BearingArms.com is the premier website for all Second Amendment related analysis. BearingArms.com. There's plenty of good sites out there, by the way, but the Reload especially has done some really good work. But of course, BearingArms.com is where you go for the complete overview. And what's your hottest Second Amendment story right now, Cam?
Well, I think right now it's the upcoming Supreme Court case. New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, which is going to address the question of whether the right to bear arms actually means anything like the right to keep arms does. The Supreme Court answered the question about whether or not we have the right to keep arms in 2008 in the Heller decision, which struck down D.C.'s ban on handguns. And now they're actually going to be, you know, weighing in on the right to carry. And they're taking on New York's carry law. So oral arguments are coming up November 3rd. And, you know, I'd say as we're getting ready for that to take place, I mean, there's a lot of anticipation. That's probably the biggest story out right now.
And I think that this is a very interesting development because you've got blue states now that are trying to restrict carry more than maybe they were in the past. And at the same time, you've got largely red states going the other direction with constitutional carry. Texas. Just a month ago became a constitutional carry state. And I believe that that's 26 states. Am I correct on that? 26 states that are now constitutional carry?
I think we're up to 21.
21.
I wish we had crossed that, you know, halfway point of more than half the country was a constitutional carry state. Probably going to take another couple of years to get there. But, yeah, I mean, you know, and it is incredible now because just even a decade ago, I think we're basically a handful of states that said if you can legally own a gun, you can legally carry it. Now well over two dozen. There are 42 states that say if you pass a background check and you have undergone your required training, we shall issue you a concealed carry license. But New York, California, New Jersey, Massachusetts, a couple of other states, they have a different view. You can pass the training. You can pass a background check. You can provide the character references that you have to provide in some cases. And still, you can be denied your concealed carry license because you haven't demonstrated a good cause to carry a gun or a justifiable need to protect yourself in public. And really that's the question that's presented to the court right now is whether or not these sort of may issue policies that deprive the average American of their ability to bear arms, whether or not these laws are constitutional.
This is the Bruin case. This is going to get to the it's going to get to the heart of this. And for those people who live in shall issue states, congratulations, you've made a good choice. But for those who live in those states, they're probably not aware of the fact that this is really at the arbitrary discretion of usually the sheriff, right? Usually it's the county sheriff that has the discretion as to whether or not to issue this. And if you have one county might have a sheriff that's more inclined to do this, one county might have a sheriff that's less inclined to do this. It becomes a sort of arbitrary decision. And that arbitrariness, I think, has to factor into the court's analysis of this.
I suspect that you're right. I had the opportunity to speak with one of the plaintiffs in this case, Robert Nash, last week, and he lives in Rensselaer County, New York. And in Rensselaer County, it's not the sheriff. There's judges who decide. And there are five or six judges. And your case gets sort of randomly assigned to one of these judges. Well, Mr. Nash says, you know, look, the vast majority of the judges in Rensselaer County, if you say I want to carry a gun for self-defense, there's no problem. But there's one judge, apparently, who doesn't like the idea of people carrying And Mr. Nash got assigned that judge. So it really was a luck of the draw that led to Mr. Nash not being able to carry a fireman self-defense. You're right. The arbitrary capricious nature of this policy is on, you know, full display in this case. And I think a lot of people would be shocked to learn that it's really just up to the whims of the issuing authority as to whether or not you get to exercise a constitutionally protected right.
And this is, I think, going to be one of the big pivot points in Bruin when the Supreme Court is finally hearing these arguments. I guarantee you that point is going to come up in the discussion. And I do think that that's going to be an important point. I also think that this is not going to be a 9-0 decision. So, I mean, stand by for how this is going to play out. But I suspect that I see the shape of the eventual decision here. Or maybe I'm just being a cynic. I mean, we're speaking with Cam Edwards of BearingArms.com. BearingArms.com. Cam, am I being too cynical, or do the numbers 6-3 play into your mind as well?
Yeah, the numbers are. You're right. We're not going to see a unanimous decision. I wish we would, because again, we're really just talking about whether or not the plain text of the Second Amendment actually means what it says. And you'd think that that would be something where we could find a unanimity. But no, I think the real question. And maybe I'm being optimistic here, but to me, the question is, are we going to be looking at a 5-4 decision or a 6-3 decision? And what does that mean in terms of the scope of this decision, right? If it's 5-4 and let's say Chief Justice Roberts doesn't come along in this case, do we have a very narrowly crafted decision that might not mean much outside of New York State? If we can get, you know, Justice Roberts along, if it's a 6-3 decision, do we then see an opinion that not only impacts New York law, but could impact, you know, California's may issue laws, Massachusetts, New Jersey, all these other states that are depriving their citizens of their right to bear arms? I'm hopeful that we're going to get a 6-3 decision. I'm hopeful that it's going to be a very strong one. But one of the other issues here, too, beyond the you know, obvious issue of the right to carry, is the standard of review that courts around the country are using when it comes to Second Amendment cases. And you know, a 6-3 decision, I think, has the potential to establish a very strict standard of review when looking at these gun control laws.
And you and I were talked about this briefly yesterday. I didn't get a chance to get too far into this, but the hope. By the way, I actually think the opposite. I think if you've got John Roberts coming along, the chances are that it's going to be a lot narrower. And if you don't have, I think a 5-4 is broader than a 6-3. In that case, I think if John Roberts comes along on anything, it's going to be to narrow the impact of whatever the decision is. So I'm actually thinking that maybe it's better to root for the 5-4. But at any rate, the Bruin case, that standard of scrutiny has the potential to impact some other cases that are percolating along the Supreme Court pipeline, too. Right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because a lot of the lower courts over the past decade or so have used this standard of review intermediate scrutiny, which is very, you know, hard to define. It's this sort of vague, fuzzy middle ground. And it's basically allowed a lot of gun control laws to stand. There's obviously, you know, strict scrutiny is the highest level of scrutiny. That's what I think gun owners are hoping that we will see. But Justice Kavanaugh has also talked about the text, history, and tradition of the Second Amendment being sort of the test that should be used. You know, do these gun control laws comport with the text, the history, and the tradition of the right to keep and bear arms? And so I'm actually curious to see what the court actually has to say about this and what standard the Supreme Court decides to adopt, because I think that in itself is a little bit of an open question.
Well, what I'm kind of interested in seeing is how that impacts the Young case when it finally comes up. That this is the case out of Hawaii, and Cam is going to laugh when I bring this up because he knows it's my favorite case in the pipeline right now, because this is the case in which the deciding judge said that Hawaiian tradition mattered more than the text of the Constitution, and I've been just waiting for that one to come to the Supreme Court. The Ninth Circuit didn't even overturn it, and so it's that's my favorite. Hey, Cam, can we keep you for one more quick segment?
Yeah, you bet.
All right, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Cam Edwards of BearingArms.com about the gubernatorial race in Virginia. You can't miss that. Lots of great stuff going on there. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com from the ReliefFactor.com studios. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh Hewitt today from the ReliefFactor.com studios, Texas edition. And we're talking with my friend Cam Edwards of BearingArms.com. We've been talking about the Second Amendment and Supreme Court, but let's shift gears here. We've got a couple of minutes here to talk about what's going on in the gubernatorial race in Virginia, where Glenn Youngkin is going up against former Governor Terry McAuliffe. And, you know, this is an interesting race. It's remained close. I am tending to think I'm a little optimistic about this, but of course, Virginia is a fairly blue state these days. Cam, you're a Virginian. What's going on there? Does Youngkin have a chance here?
Yeah, I think Youngkin absolutely has a chance. In fact, I think the Democrats are very, very concerned. I mean, as you say, Virginia has been trending blue, but this is about as optimal a scenario for Republicans as you can find. Democrats have nominated a pretty unpopular guy. And certainly a very uninspiring candidate who is not being helped by Joe Biden, who is, you know, dragging him down. McAuliffe even said that Biden is unpopular in Virginia, and yet Biden is going to be coming to campaign with Terry McAuliffe between now and Election Day. But, you know, McAuliffe is also bringing in Barack Obama. He's bringing in Stacey Abrams to campaign for him, Ed, which tells me that, you know, with about, less than 3 weeks now before Election Day,
right.
McAuliffe is still worried about shoring up his base. He's not even, you know, hoping right now to try to attract those moderate or independent voters. He's still trying to get black Democrats in Virginia to show up and vote for him because there's a third-party candidate on the ballot, Princess Blanding, who is running as the Liberation Party candidate. She's the first black female to be on the ballot for governor in Virginia. She is very strongly connected to the social justice movement. You know, she's running to McAuliffe's left. And I think that McAuliffe is absolutely terrified that she's going to be able to peel away, you know, 3, 4, maybe even 5% of the votes that would have gone to him. And, you know, that may be enough, along with what I think has been a pretty good campaign run by Glenn Youngkin. That might be enough to put Youngkin in office.
You know, and the other part of this, too, Cam, is, and this is something you brought up yesterday and I hadn't actually considered, is that Terry McAuliffe kind of bigfooted that Democratic primary process for the gubernatorial race. The Princess Blanding caucus, I guess you could say, or segment of the Democratic Party or the left, maybe a little bit more accurately the left, mm-hmm. had hoped to have a black woman running on the Democratic Party ticket in this race. Terry McAuliffe had already served one term as governor, and it's been traditional in Virginia that even though you are legally allowed to run for non-consecutive terms as governor in the Commonwealth, it's just generally not done. It's really a one-and-done type of tradition in Virginia. And Terry McAuliffe is stepping on that. He's stepping on the sort of woke crowd that really wanted to nominate a person of color, a female person of color, as a statement of where the party is going. You've got all sorts of different headwinds, not just Joe Biden, even though Joe Biden's probably bad enough in this cycle.
Yeah, you're right. Doug Wilder, who is Virginia's first black governor, has been publicly critical of Terry McAuliffe's decision to run for governor again. He was publicly critical of McAuliffe when he received the nomination. He pointed out that there were several black female lawmakers who were running for governor, who he thought would have made a stronger candidate. But McAuliffe was sort of like, he was sort of like the Biden of the Democratic Party in Virginia this year. He was sort of everybody's second choice, right, and the safe choice. But he's a very uninspiring choice. And Doug Wilder also ripped into McAuliffe for flip-flopping on Governor Northam's blackface scandal, on Attorney General Mark Herring's blackface scandal. You know, McAuliffe had called for them to resign, and now he's campaigning with them. And I think that McAuliffe has not – he's done some damage to himself among Democrats by the way he has handled himself in his campaign. Now, you know, in the waning days, clearly he's trying to call on Barack Obama and Stacey Abrams to come in and try to, you know, help him out. I just don't know if it's going to work. I don't know how well received. I mean, look, I don't think, you know, Obama's going to get criticized by Democrats in the state of Virginia, but I don't know that Obama's going to be able to move the needle for Terry McAuliffe.
I agree. Obama doesn't have a great track record in moving needles for anybody except Barack Obama. It's not his fault, but, I mean, it's just the track record. Cam Edwards, BearingArms.com. Be sure to check that out. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Ed Morrissey filling in for Hugh Hewitt in the ReliefFactor.com studio, Texas's wing of the ReliefFactor.com studio. And joining me now is Luke Rosiak of the Daily Wire, who broke a story this week at the Daily Wire. Fine conservative establishment there that Ben Shapiro helms. And this is an extremely infuriating story of how the education establishment and even the Department of Justice rushed to demonize a Loudoun County father who, as it turns out, was only trying to raise the issue of student safety because his daughter had been sexually assaulted by a male student wearing a dress in a school bathroom, a point that school officials and school board officials openly lied about. Luke Rosiak is the reporter who uncovered this in a massive expose this week. Luke, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
I mean, I'm sure that most of our audience has heard about this. This has gotten a lot of attention now, thanks to your reporting. But maybe you can go ahead and bring us back to the beginning. First off, how did you get access to all of the people who are in this, and just give us a brief rundown of the story as it stands?
Well, so, you know, this is a guy that people are familiar with his face because he was blasted all over the news for 3 months. He's a guy that's kind of a fat guy with his belly hanging out because the police are dragging him and his pants are falling down and he's got a bloody nose. He was being arrested at a school board meeting and had all these cops jump on top of him. And, you know, the National School Board Association put out that letter calling parents like him potential domestic terrorists. A lot of people thought they knew this guy. He must have been a bigot because he was arrested at a meeting where they're addressing transgender policy. Well, just 3 weeks prior, this guy's daughter was allegedly sexually assaulted in a bathroom. The police were called. Charges were ultimately filed. And the alleged rapist was prosecuted. This was a legit case. There's something really bad that happened to this guy's family. That's why he was there that day. So he showed up, and the superintendent said at that meeting, our records show we've never had any bathroom assaults, so I don't know why everyone is against this policy, basically implying that everyone in that meeting were bigots. So that's when this guy got really mad. And there's a verbal dispute, and the cops kind of try to intervene, and before he knows it, he's got, all the cops on top of him. And so the school board, basically Scott Smith is the name of the dad, and, I mean, right. He wound up getting prosecuted for that minor charge of disorderly conduct, and they tried to put him in jail. Meanwhile, the kid who did this to his daughter, allegedly, went on to do the same thing again. He was arrested just last week for allegedly assaulting a second child.
Right. I mean, this is, in part, this is, I actually think that this is a huge part of the story, Luke, because the issue here is that the school initially really wanted to tamp this down, and for some reason, and I suspect I know why, the local law enforcement wanted to tamp this down too, so people weren't made aware of the fact that this was a risk, and they weren't made aware, and Scott Smith wasn't even made aware of the fact that the perpetrator and his daughter's sexual assault had been allowed to get out of the house. He was supposed to be in house detention, right?
Yeah, I mean, the prosecutors told him they were taking it seriously and all that stuff. And to be fair, they were prosecuting him
Right.
But this, what the school system did in particular was deeply disturbing. I mean, even after that, I was asking the school system for a while before I, you know, wrote this story. Will you confirm this? I mean, will you acknowledge this? I've got all this evidence. And they still wouldn't say so. But now in the, you know, 20, I guess about 72 hours now since my story came out, as you said, it's kind of been picked up by everyone. And now some of the officials have confirmed to other news outlets, basically corroborating the main elements of the story and trying to get out ahead of it, because now everyone's furious and now they're trying to act like, oh, yeah, no, we knew about it. We didn't cover it up. But there's serious problems remaining to this day with what they're claiming, you know, and they're claiming, oh, well, we did from the beginning, report this. And I mean, there's an
email I saw that
from
statement.
The school principal in my story where he says, you know, students and parents, you may have seen police at school today. I didn't want you to worry. The police were just there because of an incident in the main office that didn't threaten any student safety. Well, that corresponds to what Scott Smith said, which is the reason the cops showed up that day is because they called the cops on me because I was mad that they weren't taking this seriously. So the school system, I mean, it's putting out these statements, and if you look at them carefully enough, they're wordsmithing. There are these mealy-mouthed statements. Scott Smith says that when the actual alleged rape occurred, they were kind of treating it as a relatively minor, non-urgent matter. And the only reason, you know, they really drove him to the hospital and did a rape kit that day, which ultimately, you know, helped build the case, was because he showed up and made a scene. And they, you know, in an email, the principal's basically saying, yeah, we had an incident today. A father was making a scene in the office. And so, you know, they did call the police on him. And, you know, if you've seen the video, yeah, he was mad that day, that separate day, June 22nd, 3 weeks later at the school board meeting. So, yeah, this is a father that's mad. This is a father that has strong opinions about what's going on in schools. But, I mean, honestly, I think a lot of parents would have handled this, been more angry than he was. He was, in some ways, kind of restrained.
Yeah, you know, and I saw the statement that the Loudoun County Public School Board put out yesterday, right, which was that the only thing that they really condemned in this was the fact that Scott Smith spoke without registering as a speaker at the school board, which I would guarantee you 90% of parents who would show up to a school board meeting probably wouldn't realize is a requirement in the first place. And in the second place, why would it be a requirement? Why would you need to register to speak at a public meeting? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me either.
Well, I don't know where that came from. I mean, my story didn't say he was signed up to speak at that meeting. Although, you know, after he was arrested at that meeting, they gave him a no trespassing order just days before the follow-up meeting where the vote was actually taken.
Right.
And so he had no option to sign up at the meeting where they actually, you know, passed that transgender policy. So, you know, the fact is this is now two girls who have been harmed. And
by the same person.
By the same person. And yeah, yeah. I mean, the school system, it's like, can you even trust these people? I mean, we're trusting our kids to these people. And there was a lot of secrecy and a lot of dishonesty here. And there's a huge sense that the people who are running our schools are more interested in politics and self-preservation than they are in education and in our children.
Well, Luke, and again, we're speaking with Luke Rosiak of the Daily Wire at Luke Rosiak. It's Rosiak. I'm pronouncing that correctly, right, Luke?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure. So be sure to follow him on Twitter. And it's not even the fact that it's politics. It's the version of politics. I mean, it was just, 3 years ago that we're all being lectured that you have to believe all women when they report sexual assaults, regardless of how long it takes and how much of the details they recall. When Scott Smith got up, and this is on something that had just happened recently where there's evidence, you know, there's plenty of evidence of the sexual assault, and it's been reported to the police. He got up and said this, and what was the response from the activists at the meeting? We don't believe you. We think you're lying. We think your daughter's lying. And that's one of the reasons why he got as angry as he did. I'm amazed that there aren't more people pointing out the hypocrisy of this. And the fact that people are basically writing off the security of both young girls and young boys in the dignity of being able to, you know, have at least some modicum of privacy in bathroom assignments, because they're more invested in the trans movement than they are in dealing with actual rape, which, I mean, it was stunning to me after the entire Brett Kavanaugh thing.
Yeah, it's disgusting. I think the way that this happened is because some people who are hard left activists have dehumanized people who disagree with them, even just a little bit. They will say you're a bigot and you're filled with, quote, hate. I mean, that's a cartoonish way to view your neighbors. The fact is, probably almost no one at that meeting, if not no one, who opposed the trans policy was filled with hate. They had differing opinions for reasons that, you know, are their own. And Scott Smith, the one case that we've gone into deeply, he had a very specific reason. But, you know, he was trying to, someone asked me, you know, why didn't he come forward sooner? Like, he was trying. I mean, on that video where he's arrested, his wife, you can hear his wife scream out, my daughter was raped and this is what happened. People weren't listening to him. You know, the school board wasn't listening to him. He was put in jail.
Right.
I mean, this guy tried to, he just felt unheard. And, you know, basically the school board passed this policy. But now the prosecutor, Buddha Bibberidge, she tried to put him in jail. She now, you know, acknowledged to the Washington Post, you know, that my story is right, that it was the same kid that was charged in two separate incidents, just a couple months apart. The Washington Post interviewed her, but it didn't ask her,
Luke,
you know, why did you prosecute the father? Why did you prosecute the father of the victim and seek jail time for disorderly conduct?
Can we hold you over for one more segment? We're going to try to keep Luke Rosiak, because I want to talk about the media coverage of Scott Smith and the incident in Loudoun County. Welcome back, everyone. This is Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, coming to you live from the Texas wing of the ReliefFactor.com studios, talking with Luke Rosiak of the Daily Wire. And we've been talking about this Loudoun County Public Schools Board cover-up of two rapes, really, in their schools. We don't know if there's more, because they're not being very forthcoming about this. And we've only got a couple of minutes left, Luke, and I want to pick up on something you talked about. The media doesn't seem to be terribly curious about this either, with the Daily Wire and now some conservative publications being the exception here. It's good to hear that the Washington Post has kind of dipped its toes into this story. But even after you had this excellent report, very in-depth report at the Daily Wire, how many media organizations reached out to you to get more information and to do their own reporting on this?
Well, I don't care if they reach out to me, but, you know, the public deserves to know about this, and
sure,
they should be, you know, building off of my story and bringing it to the readers, probably, because parents need to make sure their kids are safe. And a lot of people here were... Virginia is in the middle of a governor's election that's,
sure,
you know, polling in a dead heat, and, you know, voting is open right now. They got early voting going on. And so, you know, people have been saying, I saw someone sent me some crazy people online saying that the right-wing media is just using this case to stir it up and make sure that Glenn Youngkin wins instead of
seizing, pouncing.
Yes, like, they're seizing and pouncing, yeah.
What do you mean? I mean, I learned that two children had been raped. I shouldn't have said anything? I mean, I'm not using it for anything. I'm doing what any sane journalist would do, and what any sane school system should have done, is when two children are raped, you say something. And
right,
the fact is, if there was anyone, and there's actually quite a few groups who are not saying anything about this, it's them who feel like that would harm the chances of Terry McAuliffe for governor, who says parents shouldn't play a role in kids' education.
Right.
And so, I mean, this was clearly concealed. They had many opportunities to tell people that this happened. And they said nothing. And now they're kind of in damage control mode. But the fact is, as recently as last week, none of the officials would confirm this to me. I had to prove it myself. And now they're all pretending that they weren't covering it up. But there's, you know, children were raped and people were thinking about politics more. And so people are going to have to get over their really, really strong opinions about all Republicans are evil and everything is about politics, because it's causing bad things to happen, including to our children.
Luke, it's not just that they weren't reporting it, though. It's that they were reporting something entirely different. They were reporting Scott Smith as being some sort of domestic terrorist, to the point where the Department of Justice started to weigh in. You know, you had National Association of School Boards, NASB, requesting Department of Justice protection for these school board meetings. You had Merrick Garland get up there and talk about how this is a new form of domestic terrorism. I mean, it's not that they weren't talking about this. It's that they were lying about it, and the media didn't even bother to question that.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, they all thought they knew why someone would be angry at a school board. It's because they're Republican. The Republicans are bigots. Republicans are evil. But what's happening in Virginia now is a movement that goes beyond partisanship. It's people are waking up to we've got real problems here in these schools, and we've just got to be pragmatic and focus on education for our kids and the reading, you know, basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic, because what's going on in the schools now, they think of nothing but politics. And, I mean, these are the same schools that weren't even open for a year because of, you know, teachers' union pressure. And that put extreme psychological harm on our children. Education, they're angry that the parents are showing up at school board meetings. And, you know, Scott Smith is not a bad example of why they're showing up, because these are our communities. We have a right to be involved in policy. And the people, honestly, have been charged for a long time, have not been doing a very good job, and have not been very honest with us about a lot of things.
Luke, I mean, we've got about a minute left here. What's coming up next at the Daily Wire on this story? Are there more developments that will be forthcoming in the next couple of days at the Daily Wire? And
I believe I'm going to have a good story up today following up. I've been so busy, you know, talking to media and everything. It's been wild how much attention this has gotten. I've finally written a new story. I hope to get it up today. That is going to raise more serious concerns as Loudon is now making these claims that in many ways don't hold up. So even now, I mean, we've got to be questioning these people's honesty. And the problem is, you know, this is what they've admitted to under duress. How much else has happened that they haven't told us about? We've got to stay involved, because, you know, these are our kids on the line, and it's too important to let these people keep going the way they've been going.
Well, Luke Rosiak, Daily Wire, thedailywire.org, I believe. Is it dailywire.org?
It's DailyWire, dailywire.com.
DailyWire.com. DailyWire.com. Be sure to check that out. That is behind a paywall. This is one of those instances where it's worth it to get the subscription. Luke Rosiak, at Luke Rosiak on Twitter. You can follow him there. Thank you so much for being with us. A very important story. So be sure to follow up everybody else and press your own news organizations, as local news organizations, as why they're not following up on this story. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. Have a great day, folks.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.